Does our fill-in shoe sew? Do you have any of the announcements?
Oh, yes, the announcements. I just ran out of them.
Oh, I guess we should say names first.
Yes.
Sorry. Domeo.
Bob.
Bob. Judith.
Judith.
Daphne.
Shoketsu.
Joan.
David.
Sheila.
Dapple.
Jinryu.
Michelle.
Paul.
Yeshe.
Jeff.
Richard.
Mark.
Phil.
Ted.
Sam.
It was a hard test today.
So Saturday, this coming Saturday, is our book group. 10 to 11:30. Yeah. So please come without reading the.
Zen Teachings of Homeless Kodo.
What is it? What's the first part? Tales?
The Zen Teachings of
Zen's Teachings of the Homeless Kodo. Right. And you don't have to read ahead. You just come and listen to the discussion. And we go around reading so you can just jump in at one time. And then on the 13th is our community potluck, which is starting at 6 p.m. And it's Saturday, the 13th. At Neo Juices. Definitely. I think that's going to be in the newsletter. The address for that. So cool.
She sent it out on email.
She did. I hope lots of you will come. That's it.
All right. Tonight, I am starting a new book. I'm toying with the you'll see in the newsletter if I commit, but alternating perhaps between this book and Joanna Macy's Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, and I figured. I don't know, I kind of like alternating so that, you know, if you really don't like one of the books we're covering, you know, it's not like now you don't like Tuesdays for the next 10 weeks, you know. So we alternate so we can mix it up a little bit. This book, I just heard through the grapevine that Shintai had recommended, and it's not new, it's like 2005 or something. John Tarrant, You Bring Me the Rhinoceros and Other Zen Koans That Will Save Your Life. And I don't know why I haven't encountered this one before. I really like the way that he presents koans, which are essentially kind of teaching stories or exchanges that have been used in Zen for study. And he has a good section here which just says basically, what are koans? It says, when I tried to find out what koans are back when he became first interested, it became clear that koan is a Japanese word that has entered the English language without bringing a clear sense of its meaning. It is usually taken to refer to some sort of riddle or odd question. A koan actually has its origin in sayings or records of conversations between people interested in the secret of life. So he had already kind of introduced his own story of just seeking and questioning and wondering what it was all about. And Hosehui calls that in being interested in the secret of life. Koans originated when Chinese culture flowered around 1300 years ago, at the period of the Arthurian legends in England. In China, it was a time of willow-patterned ceramics, woodblock printing, great poets and painters, and just as in Europe, civil war. It was also a time when people grew seriously interested in the technology of the mind. Certain spiritual teachers became known for a deep and free understanding of life, and people came to learn, hoping to gain the insight that a teacher had. Some left farms, homes, and jobs in the bureaucracy to form monastic communities. Some traveled 1,000 miles on foot. These students worked, studied, meditated, and asked questions. Others maintained their work and family life and dropped in for periods of study. The teachers weren't trying to achieve something. They just responded to the needs of their students, and it turned out that some of their improvised decisions kept the process interesting. First of all, they trusted doubt and rewarded questions. This is rare in religion, and an example of the Zen way of treating what is usually thought of as a problem, in this case doubt, as a strength. The teachers also treated all questions as if they were relevant, no matter what their content. Why did I lose my love? Would have the same spiritual value as what happens when I die. A question is a place of embarkation, and any question was treated as being about enlightenment, whether the student was aware of it or not. There was a trust in whatever forces had brought the student to the point of asking. Finally, instead of giving kind advice or step-by-step instructions, the teachers responded to the students as if they were capable of coming to a complete understanding in that moment. A teacher's words often made no rational sense, yet possessed a strangely compelling quality. So we're going to read a koan, but I want to say briefly about, you know, Soto versus Rinzai Zen when it comes to koans. So these, there were actually like five or more schools of Zen or Chan in China. But really, what became the Soto school and became the Rinzai school are for the primary extant schools of Zen from that time. And it's kind of a stereotype. I mean, they've always kind of lived close to each other and cross-pollinated. But the idea is that the Soto school ended up focusing on silent illumination. That's, you know, they didn't have the term shikantaza, but they had basically what we do, the themeless meditation. And the Rinzai school, after Linji started, but all the schools were collecting these teaching stories. They're usually of the tale of a teacher and a student interacting, and then the best ones, of course, the student suddenly gets it, suddenly has some kind of insight or awakening or opening after this exchange. And then these were recorded, and then they were used by other students to try to penetrate the same thing. So in the Rinzai school, they made these collections, and then they really formalized the process. So I, as a teacher, before I could teach, would have completed a koan curriculum and gotten, you know, okay from a teacher who was, you know, empowered to teach that. And once I passed them and mastered them at a certain point, I would be empowered to work with students on them. And so it's a very, very kind of formal system. And in the Soto school, it also had koans. It had lots of teachings and koans. But they just weren't, they were never employed in this systematic way that you sit with them in Zazen, and then you come to me as a teacher, and I say, you know, what do you have to present? And then you present your understanding, and I say yes or no, and off you go, and you have to keep working on it or not. So, I don't know if that just made it all confusing or not, but I guess I would just say in Soto, it's a more of an organic process. There are teachings that we encounter that end up inspiring or intriguing or you know, presenting us with a doorway and we might work with them. Or we also say the koan arises in everyday life. So sometimes your koan of working out your relationship with your significant other, or, you know, facing financial insecurity without, you know, devolving into complete anxiety, that may be your koan. And we see it as it's all a spiritual question. Ultimately, our struggle with all of these things taps into our deepest spiritual hopes and fears and obstacles. So I think it's a valuable, you know, Tarrant is in a Rinzai tradition, but I think it's valuable for us. He does such a good job of, you know, showing what does a koan mean and how would you work with it? And it unlocks it a little bit. So he says, koans are not intended to prescribe a particular kind of happiness or a right way to live. They don't teach you to assemble or make something that didn't exist before. Koans go the other way. They encourage you to make an ally of the unpredictability of the mind and to approach your life more as a work of art. The surprise they offer is one that art offers. Inside of unpredictability, you will find not chaos, but beauty. So he says, these are seven things to notice about koans, and then I'll share a koan. Koans show you that you can depend on creative moves. Usually people think of a creative leap as something like 1, 2, 3, 4, 6. With koans, a creative leap is more like 1, 2, 3, 4, rhinoceros. What if happiness were a creative activity, like writing a poem? Koans encourage doubt and curiosity. You can have any religion and use koans. You can have no religion and use koans. Koans don't take away painful beliefs and put positive beliefs in their place. They just take away the painful beliefs and so provide freedom. Koans rely on uncertainty as a path to happiness. If you set off after happiness thinking that you know what you need, you will always end up with something that meets that need. The problem here is that when you are unhappy, it is as if you are in prison. And in that narrow cell, you think of happiness with an inmate's mind. You might imagine a more comfy cell. Consider painting the walls a nicer color or getting a new sofa. Koans don't support the interior decoration project. They demolish the walls. Koans will undermine your reasons and your explanations. Koans lead you to see life as funny rather than tragic. The example he gives is an exchange. An earnest visitor asked a Chinese master, "Where do we go when we die?" "I shall go straight to hell," said the old master. "You," said the questioner, "a good Zen master, why would you go to hell?" "If I don't, who will teach you?" he answered. Koans will change your idea of who you are, and this will require courage. Everyone thinks they want happiness, but they might not. They might rather keep their stories about who they are and about what is impossible. And koans uncover a hidden kindness in life. They show a path in which kindness is part of the foundation of the mind. So, Bring Me the Rhinoceros, which is part of a koan that he will talk about later. So this is one of the more famous koans, and so it's the koan as presented in its entirety. It's not very long, and then I'll share a little bit about his treatment of it. So you'll end up seeing these big koan collections, the Book of Serenity and the Mumon Khan, the Gateless Gate, and and it's funny because the koan is just the little exchange, and then there'll be a commentary on it, and oftentimes there'll be a commentary on that commentary by another guy, and a commentary, so there's just kind of like these accretions of commentary. So Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, what is the main point of this holy teaching? Vast emptiness, nothing holy, said Bodhidharma. Who are you standing in front of me? Asked the emperor. I don't know, said Bodhidharma. The emperor didn't understand. Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and went to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor raised this matter with his advisor. The advisor asked, Your Majesty, do you know who that Indian sage was? No, I don't, said the emperor. That was Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, carrying the seal of the Buddha's heart and mind. The emperor felt a sudden regret and said, Send a messenger to call him back. Dukji told him, Your Majesty, even if everyone in the kingdom went after him, he wouldn't return. And that's the koan. So many people find, like, koans. I talked to a guy today online, and he was just like, yeah, there's a Rinzai temple where I used to live, but, oh, man, I just couldn't. He said, my ADHD mind would just, just look at this thing and just be like, nah, I don't have time to be figuring that out. So they can seem unnecessarily obscure, but I myself am not all that used to working with the koan setup. But actually tonight when we were reciting part of Zazen Yojinki and some of that language in there that is quite poetic and obscure, and I'm thinking, you know, these are koans. Could you hand me one of those chant books? Thank you. Clear water has no back or front. Space has no inside or outside. Completely clear, its own luminosity shines before form and emptiness were fabricated. Objects of mind and mind itself have no place to exist. But sometimes we read those things and there's something. Mind and objects of mind and mind itself have no place to exist. And essentially, he'll get into this a little bit, but what it means to work with a koan essentially means to just delve into a particular story or phrase and keep it with you. Just throughout your day, throughout your practice, throughout your zazen, just keep it with you and with a sense of questioning. What is this? What is this about? So he does this really sweet thing in this chapter where he kind of I have no idea whether any of this is true or he just made it up. But he tells the story of Emperor Wu. It's kind of like a backstory to the exchange we just heard. It seems to be like he just made it up, but maybe not. But it's really sweet, because he talks about Emperor Wu having two unusual experiences that changed his life. And they were essentially inward events. And then he talks about him, the emperor going out, and all of his troops are assembled for a battle. And he's on the field with them for the night. And it's in the middle of the desert, and the environment is just intense. And it said, the wind cleansed him of any anxiety and also took away other things, the solidity of which he had never questioned before. It took away his august rank and his name. He stopped planning, and he also stopped thinking about the outcome of the battle. And then it described how in this really free space, he envisioned the best way to have battle, and they were successful. So then he said, once he forgot about having a special point to his life, he felt remarkably free for an emperor. there were some complications. On certain days, he considered leaving his room, but couldn't find a reason to. He still gave interviews at court before dawn, but was sometimes beset by a sense of unreality. So basically, he's finding it very difficult to function as an emperor the way that he did before. Having opinions about life, ideas about being an emperor, about his own dignity and the motives of his ministers, having to dislike this person and admire that one, it all pained him now. He did what was necessary out of duty and didn't mourn his old certainties, but he lacked delight. There had to be more to life than the freedom of pointlessness. So he's seeking hints, and he's encouraging sages of all kinds to travel to the palace, which is why, you know, he hears that there's this sage Bodhidharma from India, and so he wants him to come. When the sage arrived at court, he turned out to be a genuine barbarian, red hair, blue eyes, dressed in rags. His name was Bodhidharma, which was not really a personal name, just some sort of title in Sanskrit. He describes how all the ministers are decked out in really fancy clothes, and he didn't have the air of one deprived or poor. The main contrast with the ministers was not in how he dressed. In a place where everyone wanted something, he did not. The minister's rank was displayed by different differences in insignia and dress. The sage made no claims about his rank. He didn't either push himself into the emperor's notice or pull himself back into hiding. He stood quietly, and his presence affected the court until everyone fell silent. Even the most elegant palace, thought the emperor, is also a burden. Then he stood up as if to approach the visitor's stillness. He wanted to find a road deeper into his own life and asked. This is often included in the koan exchange, but he didn't. So the emperor says, I have funded many monasteries. What merit have I earned? No merit, said Bodhidharma. What a jolt, the emperor thought. Here is someone who knows. It's not about building things up. It's about undoing everything. He realized that he had fallen into being an emperor again and underestimated the sage and perhaps himself. Yes, I see. He wants to say, yes, I see it too. Now the emperor felt the man's presence as a kind of sympathy, which he longed to explore. What is the main point of this holy teaching? Vast emptiness, nothing holy, said Bodhidharma. Again, the quiet voice that didn't ask to be heard. The emperor's senses became keen. It's as if the two men were sitting together on a bench in a temple garden with all the time in the world. He wanted to reach the other man's mind, or perhaps go deeper into his own mind. An odd thought came to him. If I'm an emperor, how can I also be a person? So he asked, who are you standing in front of me? I do not know, said Bodhidharma. This statement stopped the emperor completely. He began to feel a delightful insubstantiality. The emperor's sadness over the shameful things he had done fell away. It fell into that emptiness. The emperor's worry over when more attacks would come from the north also disappeared. Inside himself, he couldn't find an emperor. But I love that. You know, in a sense, in all of these teachings, and in particular in these stories, there is this kind of backstory, but it's not a backstory that we ordinarily like fill in, because then we just go, oh, well, that's what that exchange was about. It was about Emperor Wu, sometimes they say. Which, you know, that's not the point. It's trying to point to the deeper exchange that went on here. So as I understand it, in koan stories, when you're given a koan, you know, it's not obvious what you do with it at first. You just, whatever, why did the teacher give me this? And what am I supposed to do? I guess you sit with it, and it's not until you make it real for yourself that it opens up. So he talks about working with koans, and just briefly here, he said, in the Zen tradition, if you are working with this particular koan, You are asked about Bodhidharma's three answers: no merit, vast emptiness, and I don't know. So in no merit, this is an example of, you know, making it more personal. How much do you do for praise? How many things do you say just to make an impression on others? What are you really achieving when you try to make an impression? And how many accounts do you have to keep? If you didn't do things for merit and advancement, if you didn't act with motives at all, what would life be like? At work? In bed? Alone in a room? Even alone in a room, you can be consumed with wanting other people to see you in a good light. Can you imagine how things would be without that kind of wanting? In vast emptiness, nothing holy. What is the mind like if it's not occupied with plans and schemes and fears that the plans and schemes will fail? What if your unexamined beliefs were to fall away and you were to live without them? And also to live without the thought that you had given anything up? I don't know. If you were to put aside what you know because of what other people told you, how much of what you know do you truly know for yourself? If you look for the origin of your thoughts, of your life, of your universe, can you find it? Can you find where this moment comes from or where it goes home to? So in Soto, you know, in terms of that koan that arises in everyday life, I mean, it may sound negative, but essentially, you know, what is unresolved in your life? What have you been unable to accept or make peace with? What issues have you refused to deal with or don't know how to deal with? Where is there still contraction, sorrow, dissatisfaction, anxiety, fear, anger, inhibition? What problematic scenarios recur in your life over and over, such that you can't really convince yourself anymore that it's about somebody else or your circumstances? These are koans arising in everyday life. But often they require some kind of clarification. And one of the translations of koan that I've heard was basically, or the koan tradition in China became known as like the tradition of the word. And sometimes koans are boiled down to one word, and then you're just supposed to concentrate on that one word. Because even with a little story, you're kind of thinking, well, and, you know, you're kind of philosophizing or imagining one word. And you're supposed to just break through with that. So sometimes we need some kind of handle, something that identifies and calls our attention to this. What I've also heard called the doubt mass. that sometimes we can't, it's difficult to even put a word to it. Or sometimes, you know, the words of the koan will shift over time, but now, I would love to, if the world, we had the technology that they had in the movie The Matrix, where you could just put a plug in the back of your head and you would, you know, you could know a bunch of stuff. I would learn Spanish. Yeah. And I'd probably upload a whole, you know, the whole koan collection, so that if you have something going on, I can say, hold on, you know, I've got the koan for you. Because there's something about that poetic language which takes it out of the, you know, out of this discriminatory mind level that points toward that doubt and that question, but inspires, makes it seem a little more profound, I guess. But you know, I don't have that encyclopedia of koans in my head. You know, on occasion of a teaching or something comes up. But I guess the way that we do it is, you know, identifying those things. You know, when you get together with your Dharma friends and you say, how's practice going? And then you talk about the stuff that you're, the edge of your practice, the stuff that you're still struggling with and working with, and learning to see that as a spiritual struggle. And it also helps, hopefully, if you have a skillful teacher, they can help you see things that way. I hope to be able to do that for people. I don't know how much I'm able to. Sometimes I wonder how much I'm able to convey that this is part of our process. It's difficult to describe and put words around it exactly, but you know, here's an example from my practice that, you know, I will just go ahead and confess I came up with a couple other examples, but in the interest of time, I'll just go for it. I was, you know, I can blame some of it on my upbringing, you know, the way that my parents emphasized, but I don't know, that we're also just born with karma. I don't know, I'm completely agnostic, probably atheist about previous lives or anything like that, but you know, when you watch little kids function, it's just like, how did they get that way? How did that brother act like that and that brother act like that? Why has that brother got his nose buried in a book and this brother is like beating somebody with a stick? I don't know, you know, it's just... And I think I always have had a competitive streak. That's the way that I thought that the world worked. I remember my dad giving me a lecture about there's winners and losers in this world. You gonna be a winner? You know, and so measuring myself by all of these relative metrics, right? And then by that very definition, it's, you know, somebody's always better and somebody's always worse. So there's just this sense of, you know, and it compromises human relationships because you have to constantly be on guard about whether somebody is going to, you know, move up in the relative world compared to you or how that reflects on you. And so that was a strong karmic tendency that my teacher could see in me over the years of getting to know me and listening to my issues and stories and seeing the kinds of things that arose with other Sangha members and, you know, seeing kind of the envy when I saw other people, you know, elevated or given opportunities or kudos or something like that. And, you know, I can't even really remember, you know, it wasn't like there was a koan question, but I think maybe that's why, and like in Soto, sometimes it's a lived koan. It's not a verse or a story that we contemplate on the cushion or bring to a teacher. It's like we have to live it out. So here I am kind of stuck in this community and I'm being asked to like rise above and I just am still petty. And then I had one of my more dramatic visions, if you will, on the cushion one day at Great Bow during session. I just had this vision of beautiful, a big tree, beautiful maple tree. And all the leaves on it were bright, bright, bright yellow. It was the fall, clearly, and just every leaf was luminous. And I was just one of those leaves. And that was like totally okay. That was the way, like, it was this experience of being, I can be completely individual, completely, you know, valid and bright and good and whatever. But it doesn't depend on being better than that leaf. It doesn't depend on comparison to anything. And that, like, you know, really from that point out, there was a freeing from that obsession. So I feel like that's, even though we don't do formal koans, that is the kind of, you know, not turning away from the question and the struggle, and then actually finding some answer, resolution. And it's not a trite thing. It's not like, well, the answer was you shouldn't compare yourself to others because everybody is legitimately okay. You know, well, you know, you could have told me that. But it wasn't until I really opened up to that I made a difference. So, questions or comments?
I'm really glad you're talking about koans because I can't get anywhere with them at all. I find them really difficult. And I think part of it is because in my head, you know, like, there's a should or there's a right answer, and it doesn't sound like that's the case. I mean, and it's not a book thing, you know, not until you bring it into your life or whatever is right. are you gonna start to get it. And so that's really helpful to me.
And I think one of the benefits of the Rinzai system with their whole, I mean, I don't know, there's parts of it that would just drive me nuts. I mean, I have a Dharma brother monk at Dharmarine who just spent a year and a half, I think, at a Rinzai monastery in Japan. And if you're seated like in this order in the Zendo, but if this person passes a koan further along in the collection than the next person, then the seats are switched. Could you imagine?
No.
I mean, come on. This is a bunch of young guys here. You don't think they're just like super competitive? And I mean, so that's where the Soto side will be critical of the. And actually, there's part of this in the Hongzhi's thing that we chant on some Tuesdays, which said, if illumination neglects serenity. Mm-hmm. Then aggressiveness appears. If serenity neglects illumination, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. So it's kind of like the Rinzai and Soto schools have always existed as a counterbalance to each other. Even if you're totally dedicated to one, just the existence of the other kind of, you know, pokes and keeps you from getting too wrapped up in your own way. But one of the things I do think is good about the Rinzai way is if you're going to work on koans with a teacher, you have to end up getting over that fear of wanting to give the right answer, which I have not. I mean, I've been going to see Hogan a bit the last few years, and I'm still totally wrapped up in going in there and like, even if the right answer is no answer or the right answer is just, you know, it's just like, you know, wanting so bad to be right, and not even wanting so bad to be right to show him, but I just want to be right. I don't want to be deluded and stupid and locked out of the great, great mystery that everybody else has clued into, you know? But I think that process, you're just going to have to go in and try and offer again and again, and I think people just get a thicker skin. And a little more of a like, whatever, okay, here we go. All right, that's not the answer. Off I go.
So there is a right answer?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Does the teacher know the answer?
My sense is that the teacher knows. There's an understanding in the tradition of kind of generally what the koan is about. Generally, what kind of issue it's pointing toward or addressing. But other than that, your answer could be anything. Your answer is not going to be the same answer as another person gives. It's an authentic response to the koan.
So is there really a koan that ends with the oak tree in the garden?
I think so.
Do you know which one it is?
I mean, there's not much to it. It's why did Bodhidharma come from the west? And the master answers, the oak tree in the garden. That's the koan.
Which then I think it's like, I think after a while of working with them, you get more of a, you can more readily get a sense of what that might be referring to. But I do find it encouraging, like what he's doing here. He's giving us a, you know, it doesn't seem so mysterious. You know, at first, kind of like, that seems just completely avant-garde random. But what with a little bit of background, I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, what is the motivation for practice? What are we doing here? What's the purpose? You know, it's the dandelion blooming outside. You know, which is like it's an answer in this moment that points us towards something else.
Amount of Dogen's writing is koan commentary in one form or another, right? Sometimes yeah. Very long form of koan commentary. And he actually wrote like two chapters of the Shobo Genzo on the second koan and Umon Khan, Kakujo's Fox. And I've heard people say like his interpretation of Kakujo's Fox is completely contrary to the way people normally interpret Kakujo's Fox. And these days I want to spend some real time with those. But you know, even that, it's like, we kind of use these stories for whatever point you think you can get out of them, really.
There's one that has a cow. You know what that one is?
Like, I guess I would love to have an encyclopedic knowledge of these, but...
I mean, just to understand the historical context of Dogen's writing, it's my understanding, well, a lot of his books about stories, whatever, chapters, essays, whatever you want to call them, about the monastery life, he's really talking to his audience of monks, who may in fact come from all kinds of walks of life, and many from very poor and uneducated walks of life, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, his two chapters on a particular koan, is that always his audience, or does he also have emperor wus in his life that he's
trying? I think, you know, sometimes at the end of the fascicles, it'll say who it was. Sometimes it was written for a layperson or a...
Joe Cohen was written for a layman. I love that.
So, I mean, I think a lot of them, later years particularly, that's where he was. He was just at the monastery giving lectures. But... But I do wonder, like, how much did his monks understand? You know, we kind of imagine, like, all of his monks were like, oh, Dogen. They were probably like, oh, he's going on again. Which is really funny, because my Dharma brother, who just spent, you know, a year and a half plus at Sogenji Monastery in Japan, and Sogenji's led by this total Zen master guy, and like Zen teachers go to study with Harada Roshi. And I was there for, I don't know, like 2 days or something on this trip, and like he's giving his, you know, long Dharma talk. There are totally monks going like, you know what I mean? Because they stayed up until 3 a.m. sitting so they can pass their koan and they're, you know.
It strikes me that the answers, whatever they are at least in part, if not mostly, something that is demonstrated as opposed to being explicated. And not, in other words, not some sort of an intellectual perception or understanding, but something that from deep within comes out, and the person who is in this situation is able to have this moment, this light that turns on, and is then able to demonstrate to the, I suppose, the satisfaction of the Roshi, the teacher, that he or she is onto something here.
Definitely. And, you know, somebody as intellectual as I am actually has a huge handicap in this arena, because I mean, my mind, I'm just, and my mind just gets in there. It's very difficult for me to sit with this and not think about it. But, you know, I've been intrigued, as I think many Soto people will tend to be, like, I wonder what it'd be like if I did do koans instead. At least I have something specific to work on, you know, like, but the way that I saw it over the years was similarly, the teacher's waiting for you to demonstrate it. But instead of demonstrating it in live time with what sometimes seems to me like theatrics, they want to see it demonstrated in how you live. And not just for a week, not just for a month, but pretty much permanently. How are you actually transformed by this insight or this resolution? How do you actually live it? Like I could go to my teacher and say, I have this wonderful vision of a beautiful maple tree and everybody's equal and I have to be competitive. And she could be like, that's nice. You know, that's lovely. Good for you. You know, but what she's really looking for is to see how I actually change and how I actually live.
High standard.
Yeah.
But Duncan even says, and some of his writings, don't think about it too much.
Yeah, all the Zen masters pretty much say that.
Huh?
The more you talk and think on it, the further from the truth you'll be.
Yes.
Like,
you can't get there through mind consciousness. So I'm off.
So how do we get there? I mean, that's a koan in and of itself. Zazen is a koan. Actually, when I last week I was at No Ring Zendo, and after I gave my little talk on Shikan Taza, which everybody there is working on koans, but I guess it was kind of like a, you know, interfaith sharing. And I, you know, talked about Shikan Taza, and Rinzan followed up by saying, you know, Zazen, or Shikan Taza is a koan. Sitting there, doing nothing, striving to get nothing. Why?
Yeah.
Why is, you know, why does this work? How do you surrender to it? It doesn't make any sense, but yet we do it. It's leading us toward a certain kind of wisdom.
Life is a koan, right?
Yes.
And there are no answers, right? We can ponder.
Well, except that Zen says there are answers, mm-hmm. but they're not answers that close things down. They're not answers that, oh, well, now I've got the answer and the inquiry ends, but I guess this is, you know, in particular, these are looking, like he was saying, the points of limitation that we encounter within ourselves, and that Zen says there are ways to resolve those. Not to find out how the universe actually began, but to resolve our own suffering.
I think, you know, we look for answers, but there's an understanding that is not an answer. I mean, what you read from our chant today, I could not put in words what that means, but there is a nonverbal understanding of what that means within me. I can relate to that. And so when you say, well, what is meaning of life? Well, it may not be verbal. It may not be on language. It's an understanding. An understanding. You can know all the facts in the world and not understand anything. Understanding is something that's internal.
Something Rinzon said that I've been carrying around ever since you just mentioned Rinzon, was when he first came here and he tried to introduce us to koans, he said, koans don't have answers, but they do have appropriate responses. And it's just a thing that I've been thinking about lately a lot, is that Chikantaza is a koan, but in a way, Shikantaza is also Dogen's appropriate response to the koan of life as a whole, right? Shikantaza and monastic life that, you know, I'm reading through the A.A. Kuroko very slowly, and he just so clearly loved being a monk, right? That's also his appropriate response.
Nice place to leave. Are you interested in hearing more koan?
Yeah, I just received that book and I haven't opened it yet, so I'm excited about it. Yeah. Only because I'm the one who's vocal about really disliking koans, because I think they just drive me mad and I don't want to waste any time on them, and then I begin to think that maybe I should be a little more flexible. So I got that book.
And I definitely don't intend to use koans, but I feel like, you know, exploring them and seeing how they function might help us see how our koans in everyday life function. And how, yeah. So next time will be, someone asked Zhao Zhu, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Zhao Zhu said no.
Thank you.